Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just tuning into this program, we're listening to The U.S. Economy with Joseph Stiglitz and Paul Krugman. The great Joseph Stiglitz, author of The Price of Inequality, and the equally great Paul Krugman, author of End This Depression Now, talk about the problems facing the U.S. economy.
How do you discuss alternatives to market fundamentalism in post-Soviet countries, which were so sensitive to this, to their historical experiences?
I missed which the country was.
Georgia.
Georgia. Okay.
I
think part of the, you know, it's not a surprise that people in countries where there was excessive government intervention, like communism, would react by going to the other extreme. So in that sense, I'm not surprised, but. Hopefully, and in particular, there's a real risk they go from one orthodoxy, fundamentalism, to another kind of orthodoxy, fundamentalism. And I hope that one of the things that INET is trying to do is to try to say, look, market fundamentalism doesn't work, just like the kind of Marxism doesn't work. You need to have a balanced role, and a couple of the things that we've been talking about are some of the roles that government can play, that we don't have to pick up the theme of Paul's book. We don't have to accept just a recession. A libertarian would say, just let the market work, and there are people who have said that. Don't do anything. Just let, just let the ashes burn and out of, there was one op-ed in the New York Times that said this from Chicago, said, you know, just let the markets have their way, they'll all collapse, and out of the ashes will come a new economy. In the meanwhile, there's going to be a lot of suffering.
And I'd say that's the H-Rap Brown theory of economics.
Yeah. You're showing your age and mine.
Yeah. Burn, baby, burn.
Maybe the thing to say, it's a little bit narrower than that, but we've now been, we're now almost 5 years into this crisis, and different economic ideas have people have made predictions. People have had, not so much, you know, what the number for GDP, but how things will work. There were predictions. There was a widespread belief 2.5 years ago that austerity programs would actually expand the economy because we'd be getting the government out of the way. Well, we now have pretty clear evidence that that doesn't work that way. We have, you know, the different economic doctrines have, in a lot of ways, been subjected to a test of events. And what has survived is what has worked is an economic view, a view of how these things work that does support a case for government intervention. So, you know, it's not just let's have these abstract principles and throw them out. You have to look at what has actually worked in practice, and it's not the libertarian market fundamentalist view.
And there's one aspect that picks up a point that we mentioned a little bit earlier. One of the standard doctrines of, you might say, the libertarian is more flexible wages, no unions, the economy is going to perform better. And the countries in which they have stronger unions and better job protection have done better in responding to the crisis. The United States, which is, quote, the best country in terms of labor market flexibility, hasn't done that well. So it's another experiment. I mean, what's really interesting from the point of view of economics, economic theory, and is this crisis has been wonderful. We've gotten a lot of experiments, and we will be able to test a lot of different hypotheses, and it's shedding a light on a lot of different issues at a great cost to a lot of people in a lot of these countries.
Yeah.
Over here.
This is a question addressed to both of you. What is your view on the standard decision theory of subjective expected utility in academic economics? Does it describe reality? Does it, given, especially considering your experiences in international economics and asymmetric information and other related matters?
Wow. All right.
Why don't you try, Paul?
We had a lot of economics is built around the notion of this idealized homo economicus, the rational man who's got utility, who has a clear ordering of preferences, and who which you can sometimes even express as a mathematical function, and who makes rational decisions given all of that, which obviously is not a literal description of anybody. The question is, it's a metaphor that's helpful for organizing your thinking about how decisions. decisions are made. And I think the way to do it is to always think about it in the subjunctive. If it were the case that people were like that, then they would do this, which can offer you some guidance about how they actually behave. Any economist who believes that the expected utility model of decision making under uncertainty is a literal description of how people make decisions probably should find another profession. But it's it nonetheless is very useful.
Yeah. Let me say there are two parts of the question. One of them is there's a lot of research over the last 30 years that show that people's behavior in making decisions under uncertainty is not well described by the model that Paul and you mentioned, there are significant deviations from of behavior from the prediction of that model. On the other hand, that when we think about the issue of where do probability distributions come from? Are they objective or are they subjective? The view that we ought to think of them as relatively subjective, that they reflect our experience, the way we see the world based on our experience, I think that has a lot of persuasion that to the extent that we use those probabilities and we behave according to them, then the subjective probability approach of Savage does make a lot of sense.
One more question over here.
Hi, thanks for coming. As the panel discussed earlier, the United States was able to get out of the Great Depression by government spending because of World War II and on manufacturing, in a large sense. But currently we're already at war, and the manufacturing landscape in the United States is drastically different than it was 70 years ago. And in light of those two points, where would you direct this government spending?
Okay, this is actually how I concluded End This Depression Now in my book. Let me start. The good news is that there are some natural recuperative forces already at work. So if you look, we built very few houses in this country for 6 years now. There is no longer an excess housing stock. Probably, if we were anywhere close to full employment, we would actually probably have a housing shortage. And you can see housing is starting to come back. Household debt is down. It's still high by historical levels, but not as much. So a lot of reasons to think that the economy is somewhat on the mend. If you look, the last year, there's been a significant improvement in labor markets. The point is that the hill that needs to be climbed is not as steep as it was. You don't have to have a World War II level stimulus to get us back to a much, much better economic situation. And this kind of stimulus you do want, a lot of it can be achieved just by reversing this austerity that we have, in fact, carried out. So Joe and I both have this number. We're down 600,000 government jobs, mostly state and local, when we should be up by normal growth. We should be up more than 1 million. So right there, you can create directly 1.5 million, 1.6 million, 1.7 million jobs, and then including indirect effects, probably 2.5 million or more, just by basically restoring normal levels of funding for schools, for road construction, for road repair, for the functions of government that we already have. We don't need to find exotic projects. We don't need to find something that we unprecedented to spend on. Just returning to where we would be under normal operation gets us probably to an unemployment rate well below 7%. So it's not hard.
Yeah, but I think to get back to really full employment, we will need to do more than that. I mean, if you look back, say a comparison of where we were in 2007 and where we are likely to be, we won't have real estate anything like we had before because we were irrationally exuberant. We won't have consumption like we had before, zero savings rate. You know, whether it's 4.5, 5, 6, it's still going to be well above where we were. And we are going to continue to have the problem of the trade deficit, almost surely, unless things change very dramatically. So the good news is that we have lots of things that we need to invest in. Education, infrastructure, retrofitting the economy for global warming. You know, there are lots of needs that we have. So in my mind, particularly since we can borrow now at negative real interest rates, we don't need to do anything exotic. And there is really, let me make another important point. There's this flaw this view that it was war spending that got us out. War spending is not any different from other kind of spending, right, except in one way. You don't have anything left over after you drop those bombs. whereas if you actually build roads, you have something left over. So even if you don't do it perfectly, it's better than that war spending. So the fact is that all of this kind of spending would actually put us in a better stead than the kind of spending that we had to do in World War II.
Okay, I'm running short on time here, and my staff today begged me. They said, you have two of the great original thinkers and Nobel laureates on stage with you, and Rob, give them the wheel. The last question for the Institute of New Economic Thinking. What new economic thinking do you think we should pursue, develop, enhance? Questions for each one of you.
Wow. Part of the problem is I think you really want to ask the question of a younger guy, because there is this problem of having been in it so long, you have your own set way of thinking. But look, I think we need a lot more empirical work, a lot more evidence-based work. We're seeing a renaissance, certainly in the areas I'm interested in. We're actually seeing a lot of really good empirical work on things like the effects of fiscal policy, which was much neglected, and neglected partly because it didn't seem to be a live issue, but also because we had this sort of crippling orthodoxy of believing that everything must be derived from rational behavior of individuals, and if you can't derive it that way, then it must not exist. And if we adopt a kind of looser jointed, more open-minded way of approaching how the economy works, then I think we open the door. I don't think we're ready for a lot of grand new theories at this point, but I think we have the opportunity to have a lot of people looking at how things actually work. What actually happens in a recession? What actually happens in a recovery? What happens when spending is increased or cut? We're getting a lot of natural experiments out of, you know, bad times are good for generating interesting data. And that's where I would go. I'm sure there's a lot more stuff.
And economic history.
Yes. Well, there was this great line, actually, two things. One was, I think it was Mark Thoma, the Economist View blog, who said that after attending an INET conference, he said that new economic thinking seems to consist in large part of rereading old books, which is true. I mean, there was a lot of forgetting. But the other is, yes, we've learned that history is a really powerful tool, that in some ways there was a lot of empirical work in economics was being dictated by where the data were easy to get and clean, and which means modern times. But it turns out that a lot of the interesting events mean going further back and further afield. Also, by the way, it's a special thing. International, we're better about this, but particularly in this country, there's a tendency to have to do economic research as if America was the only country. And the fact of the matter is, a lot of experiences out there, economics, the principles do tend to stay the same across time and across space, not forever and not everywhere, but you can learn a lot. If we had paid more attention, if we paid more attention to Japan and its experiences in the 90s, we wouldn't be doing such a bad job here right now.
Joel?
Well, I don't know where to begin. Since we have only a limited amount of time, it would take a couple of hours to really talk about how to begin a new economic thinking. The point where I agree very strongly with Paul is that there needs to be more openness in the way that economics is approached. I'm not sure whether the really relevant focus ought to be on empirics. I mean, a lot of the problem is the theory that was brought to bear in seeing the world led them to look at the world through the wrong empirical lens. So there are, you know, for 25 years, 30 years, there has been a lot of empirical work in economics driven with the view that markets are rational, everybody's rational expectations. So they have this very strong lens, and anything that was outside that lens, right, somehow they couldn't see, and they shaped all the empirics into that frame. There is even today, there's a professor at Harvard, even after the crisis, who's been writing a paper saying that there's this notion of expansionary contraction, that somehow austerity actually leads to economic growth in a number of instances. You know,
it's a triumph that basically nobody believes that anymore, because they've actually looked hard at the evidence, and it doesn't stop him from keeping on writing papers along those lines, but... But yeah, I think we learned something there.
Yeah, but I guess what it seems to me is that what is really important is changing the mindset with which we approach the data and the way we see the world. Within the different fields of economics, it seems to me very clear the field that has done miserably is macroeconomics and monetary economics, and to a somewhat lesser extent, but also financial economics. You know, these were fields that macroeconomics had the view, you know, that bubbles don't exist, that markets are efficient. And it was really the central doctrine of a very large fraction of the macroeconomics profession. They actually had models used by central banks in which there were no banks. You might say, that's very peculiar. How could a central bank actually talk about macroeconomics without banks? Well, they did. And their predictions were very bad, and their ability to respond to the crisis once it happened was not very good. And when it happened, they would make statements like, oh, don't worry, the crisis is contained, when it obviously wasn't. So in my mind, as we look across the fields, the big failure was in macroeconomics, in finance, where they said that, you know, these financial markets had all these efficient properties, and you know, a lot of people actually believed those models, and that was really the big mistake, both in the public and the private sector, and with enormous consequences.
And yet, if you did read those old books or those old, the odd thing is that if you had a view of macroeconomics based on what was widely accepted knowledge before this super rational expectations thing came in, ISLM, if you know that kind of thing, you've actually done spectacularly well in this crisis. I mean, it's been actually, you know, there were obviously, I think of myself as one of the people who did that, but came in with these things that seemed absurd to a lot of people. Like the notion that big budget deficits would not drive up interest rates, that big increases in the monetary base would not be inflationary, that this would in fact be a much slower recovery than normal because we'd be up against the zero lower bound on interest rates. It's a whole series of propositions which have turned out to be borne out by events. It's in a funny way, this has been a period of triumph for macroeconomic theory, except it's a macroeconomic theory that a lot of the profession threw in the waste paper basket, even though it was still perfectly valid.
And then to refer back to, you mentioned about economic history, the notion that there were no bubbles was really quite remarkable, because anybody who had read, as I had, one of my teachers was Charlie Kinderberger, who wrote this wonderful book,
all of us, yeah,
about the history of panics and
previous panics and crashes.
Yeah. And they've happened since the beginning of capitalism. And one of the things that was so interesting in this book is he describes in each of these bubbles, each of these booms, that the people in the boom knew that there had been previous bubbles that broke, but they thought they were smarter than their parents, and that they themselves were not in one of these bubbles. And that was exactly what happened in this case, that a few of the people in the middle of the bubble said, yes, of course, back in the Middle Ages, 20 years ago, we had bubbles, but we're so much smarter than our parents and our grandparents and our great-grandparents, so we would never fall for the kinds of things that they fell for, but of course, we fell for things that were just a little bit more complicated, but in many ways very similar to the same kinds of traps that they fell into, from Bernie Madoff all the way on to more sophisticated things.
So I'll take from this concluding question the notion that we should try to inoculate people from the position that they only see what they believe, and we should try to bring them back to believe that which they see.
Yeah, if not, a little bit of humility here is a very powerful thing. See what a humble person I am, and Joe too, actually. But seriously, the accepting that maybe you don't have the truth with two capital T's, that maybe these beautiful models that you've been teaching are not the only way to see the world. We had this tremendous doctrinaireness about macroeconomics. Amazingly, without any empirical triumphs to justify it, and intellectual arrogance is almost certainly a really bad thing.
Remarkable is that some of the advocates of those models that failed so badly have actually written that this is the era, even now, of the triumph of macroeconomics. So what it shows is that some parts of economics are immune to reality, well, and they are a religion, not a science. And hopefully, INET will be able to make a dent in that kind of armor.
Yes, that's what. Yeah, it's and those people will never admit that they were wrong. But it's that's the old. I'm reading about for light reading. I'm reading about the development of quantum theory, and I think it was Max Planck who said that science progresses funeral by funeral.
Well, I think tonight, far from a funeral, I think tonight you've brought a lot of life to this audience, to the questions of economics, the challenge of INET, and I'm grateful to you both for an excellent discussion. And thank you all.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
That's all, folks.